the anti-revolutionary forces win. Napoleon is defeated, or defeats himself, or however, you know, we won't go into the half hour that would take to go into all of that, right? But he goes to Russia, he comes back, he gets another army, he's defeated, he's put incarcerated in an island down off of Africa, gets off the island, comes back, puts together another army, and then they fight it out at Waterloo, and he almost takes the day again, but Blücher, the German, comes in at the last minute, and they win. So, finally we've got the genie back in the bottle, and let's send him down to an island that's further down the coast in Africa, and by the way, we'll poison him too, probably. You know, let's get So now, they literally try to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And under Metternich, the Austrian prime minister, or foreign minister, I'm not really good with titles, but the guy who's basically in charge of Austria, and especially its foreign policy, the whole idea is, let's get rid of all this French revolutionary stuff that happened, all of these reforms. Let's get all our little princes back into power and never question authoritarian power again. We need to try to get the feudal system again. You know, he had a little problem, though. A lot of people liked the reforms that had taken place. They had opened up the possibility of better trade within Germany, and there's this thing called the Industrial Revolution that's taking part, and there are people who would like to get rich, by the way. So he can't do it completely. He can't do it completely. But immediately after the defeat of Napoleon, the environment in Germany is, let's go back to the old way. Okay? And let's just be calm. And by the way, if you're not calm, we're going to have secret police listening to everything you do. And if you give a lecture in your class that says something like, Germany, Germany overall, wouldn't it be better if we were unified? And all the things that go into the words that the Deutschlandlied, you'll lose your tenure and you're going to be censored for the rest of your life. And that's what happens to a number of professors who are guilty of doing that. So they just put the clamps on. And this is the Metternich era. And it manifests itself culturally in what's referred to as Biedermeier. And Biedermeier is, on the one hand, this exaltation of the monarchies, of these, you know, rather old-fashioned rulers and their style in the 19th century, wearing all this Gothic stuff, so still tapping in that whole romantic thing, right? And the basic tendency to just lay low, just keep it quiet, and, you know, live your life in your quaint, quiet little rooms, sewing and knitting and playing the piano for the women, going to work and keeping to themselves for the men. This is Biedermeier culture. And, you know, it is kind of comfortable and it's gemütlich is what the Germans would say. And it has, you know, cute things like, you know, this worship of the old poet up there, this romantic view of the poet who's counting out his rhythms in his poem and so on, his foots in his poem, but he's not writing any poetry that would be threatening. You know, it's all very airy-fairy. The non-threatening side of romanticism. Okay? So, elves and fairies and so on and so forth for their own sake. Sort of like what Disney does with it later. Actually, the original romantics, those elves and fairies had greater significance, but we'll leave that for now. Here's a prisoner in the prison. Right? Not to mention, you know, by the way, there are people who are being thrown in prison all the time because the secret police have overheard them. Beethoven's overheard saying things like, England's got a better government than we do. Now, Jesus Christ, I want to get the hell out of here, which is the kind of thing that he did say in a restaurant. And the secret police are writing this stuff down. And the only reason they didn't arrest him wasn't because he was a great composer, but they thought he was insane. They just said, leave him alone. You know, the guy's nuts. Okay? But other people are being thrown in jail, and, you know, I don't know if they were being visited by little fairies and so on and so forth, but here's the image of what it would be like in jail. Right? Okay? So you can see how it's all been kind of sweetened. Saccharine sweet. Oh, it's 5:30. It's weird time. Okay. Now, against that, though, against that, there are these voices who are not satisfied with the way things are, which is that effort to keep the old system. Okay? They've been influenced by the French and that model. So they can imagine a German life that is directed by ideas of the Enlightenment, by ideals of democracy, and by the needs of a freer economy. This bounds them together. They are liberals, capital L liberals. They would like to see more freedom, and obviously under the oppressive conditions of Metternich, you know, this was a real cause. And they also, you know, there are economists among them who are saying, you know, we're never going to be able to keep up with England, and we're never going to be able to keep up with France if we have all these little principalities. Because every time you take some goods across, you know, our territory, you have to pay taxes at every step. You got to pay all these wimpy little princes toll to cross their bridge and use their roads and to use their inns and so on and so forth. So it's very expensive for somebody to try to trade even within Germany, let alone get your goods out. And whereas France is this large economic unit, and they're going to crush us if we don't unify, at least economically. So it's not just politics and democracy and so on, it's the economy, stupid, also, right? That's driving all of this. But they are enthused still by all those romantic notions. Right? So it's a synthesis here of the French practical Enlightenment ideal and things like going up to this medieval castle, the Wartburg, which had its own significance as a medieval castle right in the heart of Germany, but also is famous for, does anyone know who went there and translated the Bible and threw an ink pot at the devil? Martin Luther, right? This is where he hid out after he went after the indulgences. This is where he was protected from the papal authorities. So this castle has some serious cultural resonance. So when they want to go and say, we should be united, right? The Germans up in the Memel and the Tyroleans down here and those over on the Meuse, we need to come together, right? They tap into that romantic culture as well up at the top. So you have the synthesis of the Enlightenment classicism and the Romanticism functioning in these early unification movements. And by the way, when they're up there, and I don't know if it's the first time, I'm sure the Inquisition had some little parties like this as well in Spain and elsewhere, Savonarola in Florence, he did his share of this. So it's, you know, it's not nothing new under the sun, but they did build a big bonfire and they started throwing books in it. Now probably you wouldn't have that much of a problem with the books that they threw in, because they were books that were justified this authoritarian, monarchical, outdated way of organizing things that Metternich was imposing on Germany after the revolutionary period. Okay, so they were conservative books that they were throwing in there. But they were throwing books. And a wag who was writing and working in the midst of all of this, probably the funniest, most sarcastic, sardonic, critical voice to have ever put pen to paper in the German culture. And I don't know if there's anybody close. Maybe Maureen Dowd in the New York Times comes close, because that she's got a sharp tongue of a pen, I'll tell you. She just zaps Bush, and now she's zapping Clinton and Obama, and she never stops. She's phenomenal, right? But a smart ass with a pen, right? Heinrich Heine writes, well, once they start burning books, they may end up burning people too. So he went zing and got that one. Right? And he was just going around going zing, 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 and zinging everybody. The conservatives, as well as that's the beauty of a true sarcastic political wit. They'll hit everybody. Right? He wasn't a party man, and that's why Maureen Dowd's good, is because she'll hit anybody. Right? Heine saw through the issues here, that even this was dangerous. On the surface, it looked like what he would promote, because it would be against these conservatives and this old-fashioned way of doing things. But when he heard they were burning books up there, he said, well, watch out for that. Okay, that's not a good start. That's not a good sign. So this is young Germany. They call themselves young Germany versus Biedermeier. And that's basically the dynamic from the end of the revolutionary period, which is 1815, until 1848. This is just these tensions going on. And again, visions of what Germany could be. There are so many different views of what it could be. And it's also called, for those of you who are really interested, it's called Before March. Before March. Vor, V-O-R, März, in German. And if you read German historiography, it'll be referred to like this, in italics. Vor März. And that means before the March Revolution of 1848. And that's what I've described as sort of Biedermeier versus the young Germany. Those are the tensions that are going on in German life at that time. So you have those two sides at least. Now, 1848 happens. And if it's mainly a French affair. And it's mainly it's the triumph of the bourgeoisie with the help of the working class, to the point where the bourgeoisie had what they wanted and then cut the working class off and turned against them. And so it's referred to in French and in non-German political terms as the point where Europe didn't turn. It could have turned, but it didn't. It could have become a much more socialist and less capitalist system if things had gone differently in March of 1848. That's the big picture. And as I said last time, in Germany, it's a little bit different because they weren't that far along economically. So it was more a matter of, are we going to have a liberalized, unified state on democratic principles, not communist principles yet? Okay? And the French got that, and the Germans temporarily had a peek at what would happen if they had a constitutional monarchy, which is what they wanted. And then it fell apart. It fell apart. The monarch just waited it out, refused, said, I don't want a piece of paper between... Do you remember the ad? What was her name? Nothing comes between me and my Calvins, right? Okay. What was her name? Brooke Shields, right. Probably before your time, but that was a pretty randy ad at the time. Well, he said nothing comes between me and my people. So he wouldn't have this constitutional monarchy between himself and the people. So Brooke Shields, she should have quoted the Friedrich Wilhelm IV or whatever it was who said that. So it petered out. Now, in that struggle, 1848, a voice appears looking at all of this and saying, a specter is haunting Europe, the specter of communism. And the bourgeoisie has been the revolutionary force. It has moved mountains, it has moved oceans, it has transformed nature, it has transformed the way of life. It has eliminated all fixed fast forms of existence. It has undermined the feudal, it has undermined the rural stupidity, right? But it has created an underclass that is doing all of the labor and has been transformed into machines who have no existence other than that which is necessary for survival. And that proletarian society is going to grow and grow and grow. And the small businessman is going to be eaten up as larger corporations take over and take over and take over. And ultimately, you're going to have this centralized economy where just a few companies own everything. They're going to buy out all the bookstores, and they're going to buy out all the hardware stores, and they're going to buy out all the sports stores. And one company is going to own all of those. And it's going to become this, that so few are going to own so much, right? And the masses are going to be so disaffected with this that there's going to be a crisis. I don't know how the crisis is going to come about, but that crisis is going to happen. Eventually it has to crack. And when that happens, the proletarians are going to seize control of the means of production, and a socialist utopia is going to occur. Who was saying that? Karl Marx, okay? Comes out in 1848. The Communist Manifesto, it takes place, it is articulated during that period. And what Marx does, along with many others, is to say, we have got to pay attention to the life of those lower classes. Right? The Biedermeier culture and the Romantic culture has been staring off into space. It has not been paying attention to the reality, and to quote Bill Clinton from 16 years ago, it's the economy, stupid. Okay. So Marx is representative of this, but also very influential, and he influences a lot of artists and a lot of writers who commit themselves to the cause. And the cause is, first of all, to point your attention to these realities. There are factories growing up. And there are cities growing up, and there are train stations being built. And this is the world that we live in. We don't live in that airy-fairy fantasy world of the Romantics. But there are problems there. Some people are poor and suffering in this world, and their fate can't be ignored. Their fate can't be ignored. We've got to pay attention to what's happening down there. And if you're for them, you're going to say, we want to pay attention to them, and we want to give them a sense of self-worth, and we want to encourage them, and we want to educate them so that they will, when the time comes, be capable of taking the revolutionary action that is inevitable. And so we're going to teach them to recognize, to become conscious of themselves. This is the goal of the revolutionary avant-garde, the most of whom are middle-class people themselves. You're going to have this avant-garde that's going to lead the way, and then the masses will follow. Right? So that art is going to serve those purposes. First of all, it's going to draw attention. And that might convince some people of the middle classes and the owning classes to treat their workers a little bit better and to accept compromises and to allow for, you know, 30-hour work weeks and start having fewer child laborers and so forth, and provide some social insurance and so on. That would be good, okay, for a while, right? But the ultimate goal is to motivate the working classes to act and ultimately result in a socialist system. And this is present, this voice is present and articulated in the texts of Marx and Engels and in the propaganda of the socialist and communist movements, which grow. So the Socialist Party itself grows to the largest party in Germany by the turn of the century. For reasons I might mention, that doesn't have any mean that they have any actual control, because Parliament in Germany is still slanted toward the aristocratic and wealthy powers that be. So even if you're the largest party, that doesn't mean you have that much authority. Right? But the Socialist Party is the largest party in the beginning of the 20th century, going to the First World War. And this art is dedicated to representing its ideals. So you have another Germany here now, the Germany of social democracy, the Germany of socialism, informed by Marxism, but all the variations within the socialist world that ranges from extreme revolutionary activity like the anarchists to trade unionism that would result in reforms that would improve things over time and might actually mitigate things to the point where there won't be a revolution, because people will have cars and soap and TVs, and they'll be so numbed by drinking bad beer and watching TV that they'll never have a revolution. which is basically the way things panned out, right? But so here we have the emergence of this left-wing Germany that has another vision of what Germany should be and which direction the nation should align. Everything that I've talked about so far, since this beginning of the survey, you have to realize there is no Germany. There's no Germany. Germany does not exist. There's no such animal. And, of course, that's the bone of contention. Do we want it? Conservatives in the Vormärz period, they don't want it. They don't want a Germany. We like our princes. We like our principalities. We want to govern our individual little states. Right? You have to remember that. So when those people are marching up the mountain and saying, Germany, Germany, all above all else, right? That's what they mean, above your silly little principalities and their interests. Right, it's against these princes that they're having to argue, right? And they're saying we are something that's unified on this basis. From, you know, let's not worry about the borders right now, right? That's what they're arguing. We need to think in those terms rather than just you and your little what you have and protecting that, right? And that first movement does want to do it in pretty liberal terms. So we can look back at it and say, okay, they burned books and so on, but at that time it's not quite that scary. It's not quite that scary. And then there's socialism, which is an international movement. Okay, so that's going to tap into a whole thing, and it's going to be countered by, this isn't German, this is international. And by, you know, that can be turned in later into this is Jewish international conspiracy and so on and so forth, but it's against our interest. But it's certainly a notion of something bigger than these little principalities. Right? So you could have a national socialism. Right? You could have a national socialism, socialist system within a national framework. That's an option. And when you hear that, try not to let the booga 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 go in your head. Okay, because you got to understand that national socialism didn't sound freaky. It didn't sound like throwing babies into ovens then. You know, it sounds like, okay, we're going to have a socialist kind of economy within a national framework. Is it possible to do that? Maybe we can do that. Right? So it's not, you have to, from a different perspective, it doesn't have that. So all of these options are out there. And this is why this German thing is so complicated and, you know, to a certain extent fascinating, but explains why it's been an issue. Because, can you see? I mean, we're only halfway through. Can you see how complicated it is, right, for them to figure out who the hell they are and how they're going to represent themselves and how they're going to organize themselves within that, whatever that's going to be? It's an ongoing question. Well, the first temporary solution, of course, is that initiated by this guy. And actually, I should have a picture of him younger, because here he's really old. That's not quite, you know. Bismarck's a character. Now, restrain me, all right? But this is a character. He is a Junker, right? You asked about Junker last time, didn't you? You did, I'm sorry. Aristocrat. And he embodies the whole Junker aristocrat. Junker aristocrats are like Texans. Okay? They've got these big tracts of land up there and they walk around in cowboy boots. And they've got millions of dollars from their oil. That's not what the Junkers have, but this is their whole thing. And they sit down in New York with their cowboy boots and some cow poop on the bottom of it, and they have a quid in, and they want to have a barbecue. Okay, this is not exactly what the Junker are, but they're this earthy variety of German aristocrats who come from their farms, and they like everybody to know that, and they don't take baths, and they smell, and they wear leather, and so on. And that's the role that Bismarck played when he was a young man. He was huge. He was a big guy. I mean, for the 19th century, he could probably play line in the NFL through most of his life, and that was, you can imagine how huge that would have been for the 19th century. I don't have the statistics here, but I think he's cracking 300 by the time, he's in the middle age. And he's a big, tall guy. And he walks around at the university with these big leather boots up to his hips, and a broadsword. And he's just walking around looking for anybody who looks at him crooked. And he's going to spank him with that broadsword and say, you know, shut up, you intellectual pig. And this is his whole thing. And he's very conservative. So more on that. I mean, he drank beer like, you know, and got in duels and so on and so forth. Then hung out on his, I mean, there's an image of him. He liked to sit in his living room with his feet up on the windowsill and hunt for deer out his window, okay, after he went to university. So that's Bismarck, young Bismarck. And then when the 1848 goes, he's like, whose ass can I kick right now? I want to kick ass, and I don't want these revolutionaries to get anywhere. And he runs around, and he gets his own little private army. And he's running around saying, we're going to kill them, right? We're going to kill them all. And the Prussian king goes, no, we're just going to wait. We're just going to wait. You watch. How many of you have seen Lawrence of Arabia? Okay. This should have been played nightly, 24/7, in the Bush administration before they rolled. Okay? Set that aside. But do you remember when Lawrence has the Arabs united and the English say, what are you going to do? We're going to wait. Turn off the power. And then they just wait, and the United Arab Parliament just falls apart, and they go running away, and so on and so forth. Well, that's what the Prussian king did. And Bismarck wanted to, but he learned a lesson there in patience. Okay. Restraining myself, I'll say. He's shown himself to be a worthy subject of the king, and that's remembered. And gradually he's given some a position in foreign affairs, and he does some good work in foreign affairs and so on and so forth. Becomes the king's most loyal advisor, very conservative. But always, 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 Bismarck says, I'm only one thing. I am the subject to my king. And all I ever do, and all I think about, is what can I do for my king of Prussia. I don't care one hoot for Germany or for the German nation. All I want to do is do what's best for the Prussian king. He's absolutely consistent in saying that all the way. And so all the machinations that he brings about, what he does is he sees the best thing I can do in this turbulent time where Germany could go in any direction, right, is to put my king at the center of it. Even if he doesn't want to be emperor. And Bismarck had to get down on his knees and cry and beg, please, 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 please be the emperor. He'd pull this crying game. You've got a 300-pound, 6-foot-4 guy in front of you crying and you're laughing, please do this. And that's how he convinced Wilhelm to accept the emperorship in France. So the king didn't even want to do it, but he knew this is what he had to do to keep Prussia in the center of things, otherwise Austria would be, or Bavaria, or the whole thing would fall apart. And he just felt that it was best for the Prussian king to be in the center of it. So you can put all political theory and everything aside. He didn't give a damn about any of that. He just wanted to make sure that Wilhelm I was properly positioned when this all went down. Well, how did he do it? Most famously, through blood and iron. Okay? That's what he did. He triggered a war against Denmark over, nobody can still figure that one out. But it's very complicated, and you can read it and figure it out and then forget it. But he initiated a war against Denmark with Austria helping. So they beat Denmark, and so he had the Germans behind him, and Austria was helping, and that was great. So he's kind of got this momentum going. And then he says, yeah, but Austria's a pain in the butt. They've got Balkans, they've got Balkan interests, and they're really, if we have them in the state, then Prussia's never going to really be in control. Because Austria is always going to be nagging at us. So, fights a war against Austria. Against Austria. You know, Germans against Germans. Defeats Austria, puts them over in the corner, and then convinces the Bavarians to side with him, which was the other big piece in the puzzle. Right? And then manipulates Napoleon III into a war over nothing between France and the other German states. And they triumphantly, using techniques that they had learned by watching the American Civil War, which the French didn't pay any attention to, using trains and automatic weapons and so on and so forth, they defeated the French handily, and while in France, declare themselves united in this thrill of the moment. And he gets Wilhelm to accept it. Now you have Germany. I think I went over that last time, but remember, it's not the large German Germany. It's a small German Germany that doesn't include Austria, doesn't include other territories that the large Germany would be would have included as well. Okay. So what happens then is that you have, first of all, much better economic possibilities. Now there's a depression right away, for whatever reason, I'm not an economist. But for the first few years of the New Reich, there is a depression, and that stuns some people, okay? They go through a depressed period from 72 to 76, or something like that. I mean, a really bad economic period. And I haven't read the literature on that to know why. But it brings into question the possibility that economics really weren't served by this. And it's important to realize, because there are people who are going to question this Reich. It's not big enough, right? And it didn't really solve our economic issues. Okay, so Bismarck has his critics. But for the most part, this is the era that's called the Founders' Era, or the Gründerzeit. And whatever the initial problems were, this is when the great businesses are founded. This is when the state is founded. This is when Berlin starts to build into this huge industrial city like Chicago. If you go to Berlin, it feels a lot like Chicago. Because it started growing in 1870, 1871, right after our fire. Right? So the buildings are being built up at the same time. I always sense the same thing. It's not a nice little Gothic town. It's a big, brawny city, just like Chicago. And so this is all founded, and that's why it's referred to as the Founders' Site. And in culture, you have the development of this national culture that taps into that romanticism and that classicism, right, in order to symbolize itself. There are hundreds of these Bismarck towers. Every little town in the new German Reich builds these things in order to honor him. So these Bismarck Türme, right? And you can see the mass demonstrations. Here are the armies coming back from defeating the French and unifying Germany. Right, and you have paintings commemorating. Here are the soldiers, officers, just thumping around in their dirty Junker boots, you know, in all of that French finery. So here's that contrast between German, gemütlich, powerful, singing Schubert songs with mud on their boots. In the midst of all that elegant French grace and frivolity and so on, right? There's a contrast for you. Or you have, you know, the painting commemorating the moment where all the German princes raise their swords in acknowledgement, giving their oath to Wilhelm I as their emperor. And there's Bismarck bringing that all about in the Hall of Mirrors of Versailles. Right, so a lot of painting, a lot of building, a lot of architecture symbolizing the founding of the state and the founding of this new nation. Okay? But there are those voices out there saying, it's not enough. Right? It's not emotional. It's too practical. It's too much politics and not enough soul. It's not big enough. And look, the economy didn't get that much better, right away. So, you know, there are issues here. And besides, you know, we don't care about money. We don't care about goods and products and cities and technology. That's not the German soul. The German soul is romantic. We care about the woods, and we care about the mountains, and we care about the sky, and we care about the stars, and we care about poetry, and we care about music. That's German culture. If all we're doing is putting together a state so we can better trade, That is a state without heart. That is a state without soul. So that romantic voice keeps coming up and rejecting the practical, real politics that Bismarck used to construct the state. Realpolitik. Okay? Real politik with a K. Realpolitik. Right? They reject that. And so this whole culture, which builds up during, underneath, it's been around, and these images don't really capture it, but it's been around since the Revolutionary Wars in this romantic format, but it starts to come out in a very bitchy form, you might say. And it's referred to as folkish ideology. That's the German, folkish. But it's used enough in the literature that it's been Americanized to folkish, so you can spell it either way you want. And folkish ideology is, these are the intellectual roots of Nazism. Okay? This is what Hitler tapped into. But it pre-existed him by, pre-existed his movement by 40 years. It exists from 1870, 1880 on. And what it consists of is these people who are saying that the Bismarck's right is too much of a superficial thing. It's not the real thing, and it's not big enough. And these folkish thinkers are saying what we need is a spiritual unity that's based on culture and blood. Culture and blood. Culture, capital K culture, that romantic culture, and blood, that what holds us together. And it's in this world that you start to hear there's us and there's them. And that them is starting to be a problem. Ever since they were emancipated by Napoleon, they've been eating away at our society and pushing us toward this materialistic, superficial, soulless kind of life of the city. We don't want to blame other Germans for that. The other Germans who are responsible for it, like Bismarck, and like the German businessmen and so on and so forth, they're just pawns and they're being manipulated by these outsiders. Right? Because if you see things in terms of blood, then it's a contradiction that people that are of your blood are doing things that are counter to what you expect. So there must be some other explanation for it. These outsiders who've become insiders, we let them in. We let them in. And now what they've been doing, as they do in every society that they infest, right, is to undermine our society, and it's resulting in decadence, and it's resulting in decline, and it's resulting in immorality. Right? And we've got to gird ourselves against that, work for a pan-German that includes Austria unification, ultimately, that will take care of this materialistic manifestations of the new Reich. Capitalism is bad. Cities are bad. Urban world is bad. Right? But so is communism, and so is socialism. That's bad too, because that's really only economic as well, and what it promises isn't going to be better than that. It's even more of another version of it. So left and right are both bad. Right? And if you can get your brain around this, they're both part of the conspiracy of these sneaky little parasites that are working in the background and pulling strings and manipulating the true German soul. Right? And they do have their followers. They do have their followers who've lost their true German soul, like Bismarck, right? But what we're going to have to do is get rid of them. And you know who they are, right? But that voice is starting to creep in the 1880s. It was around a little bit before. Cultural anti-Semitism existed. Religious anti-Semitism existed ever since Rome. Okay? But this is different. This is racial anti-Semitism. And for all of their talk about spirit and culture and Geist and so on and so forth, as far as anti-Semitism goes, they like science. That's the one place that they say, oh, well, see, science tells us. And what they do is they tap into the scientific tradition of the 18th century that starts to organize this natural world into different families and genuses and phyla and all of that stuff. And they start to do the same to human beings. So there are Negroid, and there are Caucasian, and there are Aryan, and there are Jewish, and there are all Slavs, and we. And the difference between this and cultural / religious anti-Semitism is, in the case of cultural and religious anti-Semitism, you can always convert. You can convert. Okay? And then you're in. There's always going to be a glass ceiling for you, but you're in. You've converted. Right? Because it's cultural. It's a choice. It's a religious choice. But if it's scientifically based racial anti-Semitism, you can't convert, no matter what you do. If your father has been in Germany or family's been in there for three generations, two of them died in the battles outside of Paris for the unification of Germany, three uncles died in the First World War, doesn't matter. You are of separate and distinct blood, and therefore you are a threat. And the only way to eliminate a physical threat that way is through elimination. Those are the kind of words that are creeping in to German culture in the crags and the cracks of Wilhelmine culture, society, in the 1880s and 1890s. Okay? It didn't exist before that, but it starts to exist then. It's a small, sneaky, little background whisper going on in the 80s and the 90s. Okay? It's just some crackpots, and that's why nobody paid attention to it. Even scholars, after the Holocaust, didn't pay attention to it at first. They saw National Socialism as a political thing, they looked at it as a political thing, and they didn't see it as a cultural thing, because these people were such insignificant individuals. One person was significant, Richard Wagner, but he tapped into a bunch of names. If I told you right now, you've never heard of him. Okay? And he influenced them. But Wagner's key, but I won't go into that now. That could take the whole semester. But the important thing to remember is that that's when that voice starts to show up, saying those things. And it's really a reaction against the practical aspect of Bismarck's right. Now, I guess I'm done. There's another voice that I want. I don't know why that happened, but it's kind of funny. There's another voice that is equally critical of Germany and Germanism at the turn of the century, which we need to pay a little bit of attention to for the rest of the course, not so much for the book that we're going to read. But it is the voice of the disaffected intellectuals. Of disaffected intellectuals who look at Bismarck's Reich, the nationalism that's growing, the sort of cockiness that's emerging, and especially the materialistic aspects of it as the Industrial Revolution really does kick off in Germany, and after that stutter step, it does, and it happens fast. You go from, you know, you'd have to look at the statistics, which is something that I don't do, but, you know, they go from one train track to, you know, having the most trains in any region in the world in like 20 years. And Berlin goes from being this to that, and there are factories everywhere, and then suddenly they're the biggest steel producers and they're the biggest chemical producers, and boom, they hit it hard when they finally hit it by the turn of the century. And the economy is being transformed, and you have the laborer, and you have the proletarian society, and of course you have the socialists saying that, you know, this is happening, and the poor are getting bigger, and the poor are getting more important, and shouldn't we try to motivate them? So that's going on, right? Turn of the century, socialist parties getting the biggest one. So you have that vision of what's going on. You have the little, I can't try to, who would he be related to? Some, like, who's whispering into the Dark Lord's ear? Like parcel tongue. Right? That's the folkish thing at this point, right? And then you have these intellectuals who are saying a lot of the same things that the folkish guys are saying. And frankly, if I had presented them first, you'd be going, right? Yep. Materialism is eating away at the soul. We're much too focused on getting and spending, right? We're much too focused on measuring ourselves in materialistic ways against other people. And as a result, the soul is being mechanized. So people are out of touch with themselves. They're alienated from themselves. It's a combination of a Marxist critique and a romantic critique. And there are overlaps there. And artists all along here have been saying, you know, you're just so caught up in that material me, you're not seeing the bigger me, right? Or you're caught up in the superficial and you're not seeing what underlies it. And that there are passions, that there are emotions that you need to pay attention to, and art should be dedicated to helping you see that. And instead of just becoming blasé about life, to make you very sensitive to life. And this voice is always there, but it becomes very, very intense by the term in the fin de siècle. We use the French term for it generally, right? Because the French version of it's happening over there, and people like in France, Baudelaire, Rimbaud, Mallarmé in literature, Vincent van Gogh, Paul Gauguin, Picasso in painting, Debussy and Satie, and I'll think of some others in music. They're all starting to use their art in much more nuanced and subtle ways in order to communicate the complexity of the human mind and the human soul. That it's not just this simplistic, I need this, I'll be happy with a house, I'll be happy with a wife, and that's it, I'm going to be satisfied. But it requires a much more complex awareness of self. And a big thing that's being overlooked, because the Industrial Revolution is driven by middle class values and middle class perspective. Okay? And that is a replacement for Christian values, although it incorporates them. But it's a new ideology that emphasizes hard work, thrift, responsibility, good things, using reason, competition, fine, okay. but also repressing the senses. Repressing the emotions, repressing the passions. It's all very neoclassical. What do you do when you have to go out into the job market? It's coming off, buddy. As soon as you walk down there and try to get a job, it's coming off. You can't look like a romantic who's trying to look like a medieval who's trying to look like Christ if you're going to go out into the job market. You're going to have to get a good neoclassical Roman haircut, right, and step up, all right? And dedicate yourself to this, and that, by the way, also means being sexually responsible, right? Because we'll call it the Protestant work ethic incorporates that Protestant uptightness about sexuality, right? And so, where things were much freer under the old world, as long you could sleep with anything in the old regime, nobody, that was your problem with God, okay? Just don't question the king, okay? No problem. Those aristocrats are, you know, every which way. And just look at the Rococo paintings to find out. Okay? They don't care in the old regime. That's between you and God. Right? But it's not, it's a public matter. Because they want to open things up for you to be free economically and free politically, but they're going to have to keep constraints on you so you don't go wild and either murder or sleep with everything that gets in your way, right? So you have to balance out the freedom of the new democratic capitalist world with a greater attention to moral and ethical behavior. So that's why we Americans are like this. I see so many sexy butts on TV. but I can't do anything about it. Right? There's this tension going on. Right? Where the corporations give you this, but then pull it back. Right? That's the world we live in. And that's the world that these artists are responding to. We have sex, don't we? Isn't that an important part of our lives? But we can't talk about it. This is the Victorian age, right? They're in corsets. The dress is all the way down here. They have 14 layers of underwear. Okay, you have to cover the layer of the legs of the chairs because legs can't be seen, right? And if your daughter happens to get caught with somebody else, not only is she ruined, but so is the reputation of your whole family. So you might as well all just pack it up and get on the streets because no one's going to talk to you anymore because your teenage daughter went and had a sexual relationship with somebody, right? So the pressure is on the daughters, big time. Huge pressure on the daughters. Guys can go out and do whatever they want, keep it under cloak, as long as they don't get somebody pregnant, and now they're in trouble too. Okay. So these artists are saying, there's got to be more passion, there's got to be more soul, there's got to be more existence. But they, unlike the folkish people, they don't look backward for the answer, back to the Middle Ages. Back to the chivalrous age, back to something that will provide, get us out of this urban malaise. They look forward. The answer to the problems of modernity is more modernism. So you need to be more open. We need to be more open about sexuality. We need to acknowledge homosexuality. We need to speak about our passions. We need to get it out. We need to do the talking cure as a society, not just as individuals. So ideas like those of Freud are floating around all over the place in the turn of the century, even before he gets them out down in his beautiful long hand. He's an incredible writer. But you've got artists like Wagner, who has a lot of different guises, but you have artists like Wagner, you have musicians like Wagner, you have musicians like Schoenberg, you've got musicians like Richard Strauss, who are actually depicting in music the sexual act. I was just listening to Transfigured Night the other night, and I'm telling you, it's about sex. It's happening there. I can see it. I can feel it. There's no doubt about it. The act is going on in a very explicit way, but it's all violin, so it's okay, right? You've got Gustav Klimt painting the aura of sensual bliss and the intersection between male power and female power in this golden, radiant world where the mean room and the average bed has turned into a bed of flowers and a shimmering, golden world that was reserved for heavenly depictions in the Middle Ages. Okay. Bliss. Right? And you've got Freud over there going, tell me. I'm safe. You can tell me. I won't tell anyone else. Just let, what is it you dreamed last night? The rats ate what? Okay. Didn't it feel good to get that out? Right? If you just talk about it, you feel better, don't you? Right? But you don't talk about it. And that's why we're all like this.
I have a question. What's the artist that did the painting?
Klimt. The kiss. Klimt's the kiss is what I was referring to. K-L-I-M-P. Okay. So, some of our... Here it is.
Sexy.
Do women actually enjoy sex? Unbelievable. That's bad. I'm living in my own little world over here. And I won't even tell you about Nietzsche for now. Right? So all of these things are churning. The complicated Suppe, at the turn of the century and moving up to the years just before the First World War. And this is the world that Thomas and Heinrich Mann are born into and start to observe, like sensitive nerves, just locking in on these things. Mann's really representative of this world of deep psychological introversion, exploration, right? Influenced by a very important early 19th century thinker named Schopenhauer, who says, you know, it's will, and what's behind will is sexual desire, very early, and nobody really paid attention to him. Wagner, who is communicating that will in music, and there's a lot of sexual desire there too, in addition to anti-Semitism and Germanic politics, but Mann likes that. And Nietzsche, who is, you know, telling us, you know, it's all in the mind. It's all a construct. You construct these forms and you live by them in order to be comfortable with yourselves, right? But really, there's no you, and there's no me, and there's nothing there except what we construct. And you need to be comfortable with that and recognize it. And if you can look at it and observe that, then a lot of your uptight problems will go away. That's a sort of a Buddhist version of Nietzsche. But it's not too far from the mark, because he and Schopenhauer were reading Eastern philosophy, and it's not too, you know, it's not too distant from that, to be honest with you. Thomas Mann is tapping into that. But he thinks, well, you know, we are really all pretty repressed, and it's going to be really hard to get through. So a lot of his stories about people who come to the point at the beginning of the 19th century of awareness, through some sort of crisis. This is what their stories tell, his stories tell. Somebody who's lived in this uptight world of business, or maybe this uptight world of being a German cultural leader, in the case of Aschenbach, but he's been like this. And for something happens in a lot of these stories, and they finally go, oh, I'm gay. I didn't know it, but I am. And I think I should live in a more genuine and honest life. But I can't. I can't do it. I'm too scared. I just don't have what it takes to really break through. So that's what a lot of his stories tell. And so he sort of encompasses that modernist view of things. And then Heinrich is the socialist. Heinrich is the social realist who says, okay, that's all very nice. Yes, we have sex, Thomas, and yes, maybe we're all repressed and we need to break through. But God damn it, just as Marx had said before, we have got to pay attention to what's happening to the poor. And we've got to pay attention to the people who are governing our society and becoming leaders. And they are caught, they are really... either enthusiastic about Bismarck and his Reich, which now is being governed by Wilhelm II, not Bismarck, and his desire to find Germany's place in the sun and all the things I talked about last time, not paying attention to the treaties that were kept to keep Germany from having to fight a two-front war, irritating the Russians, irritating the French, irritating the British through various ways, right? Brashly threatening to destroy the working class movements if necessary, through, we'll talk about this, bringing about what might be justification for a internal strike, a civil strike, to knock out the left, because it is the largest party in German politics at the time. Or you have people who are starting to think in these folkish terms and are starting to look at because they don't have a self themselves, right? They look to build their identity by contrasting their their situation with some sort of external enemy. This is how I derive my identity, by blaming other people. Ooh, I don't like the city. Ooh, I don't like capitalism. Ooh, I don't like that. Well, it's the Jews' fault. And I can derive a sense of self-worth and identity by doing that. And Heinrich Mann is saying, we have to look at this very carefully, and we have to go, we can use the tools that you're using, Tomas, to self-explore, Freudian psychology and references to spirit, but it shouldn't be dedicated to a modernist culture of self-revelation. That's not what it's about. It should be dedicated to understanding what we perceive to be the enemy, and that is this conservative right-wing orientation that's leading us in the direction of military catastrophe. So I think that gives us the background to understand a lot of the symbols and figures in Heinrich Mann's Loyal Subject. As this new man, the Neo-Teuton, right, emerges in what is really a sarcastic novel of education. What Mann is doing is there's a tradition in German literature called the Bildungsroman, the novel of education. It follows the development of a character. In a Bildungsroman, you know, the idea is that that character is going to end up like Goethe. It's going to be a great balanced, you know, creative humanist figure. And what Heinrich Mann is saying is, okay, I'm going to do a Bildungsroman of how these creatures, your average German nationalist, patriotic, abrasive character emerges in this environment, with reference to all of these other concepts that go in to the notion of what Germany is or could be. So I didn't get to the book. But I think you'll be able to read and understand the book a little bit more with some of these background things in mind. And we'll do that all of next time.
Was there any